Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 26th of October. Monday at 9 is All Things Political, and we have much to talk about today. We'll be looking, of course, again at health care. Some Democrats now are saying that they want to push the White House and key Senate leaders to speed up key benefits in health reform to the year 2010 to give the party something to show taxpayers for their investment. We'll look at what is likely to happen, why courting the vote of Olympia Snow, if that indeed is what's happening. The news is not very good from Afghanistan, as you heard from National Public Radio just a moment ago, where 14 Americans were killed in helicopters. The news from Iraq is not very good. Twin car bombs devastating three government buildings on Sunday and killing more than 150 people. We'll talk about that country as well as whatever you would like to discuss for All Things Political. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And our guest this hour is Professor of Political Science at Duke University, John Aldrich, who specializes in American politics and behavior, formal theory, and methodology. He's working now on studies of various aspects of campaigns and elections, political parties, the political effects of economic globalization, and Congress. He's written for the American Political Science Review, American Journal of Political Science, Journal of Politics, Public Choice, and many other journals, and is the author of a number of books on political parties and conventions here in the United States. We'll welcome phone calls for him during the course of this hour. Professor John Aldrich, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Let's start on the domestic front before we go to Afghanistan and Iraq. What do you think is going to happen now with that? We've talked about this for so long. Healthcare reform. Are we looking at something different, what the Senate wants, what the President wants, what the House wants? Is the public option off the table for the White House? It's a little confusing.
It should be. They've worked hard to make it so. And I think they've been, that's the one part that's clearly successful, I think. Is confusion. I'm not sure they actually have any good forecast themselves of what's likely to happen.
Do you know what it is that the administration wants? We hear conflicting reports that at one point it's the president really wants a public option. Now we're hearing that the president favors a trigger kind of plan where the public option would kick in if it wasn't working very well. Why is there so much confusion on the part of the administration, at least in letting us know what they want?
Well, it seems to me that we need to start with the bottom line, which is they need a bill.
Mm.
And of course, they need a bill that they would like to have one as close to, you know, what the president's, you know, true preferences, if he could just sit down and write one and it become law himself. Would like. So there's, he is a gap himself between what's the minimal, you know, feasible, passable bill that's most likely to be passed and what he would like. And so he, too, is in this bargaining process with House, Senate, Democrats, and Republicans. It's called the separation of powers and separated and balanced powers.
Do you imagine that a bill will be passed before Christmas?
I think there's a really good chance for that, because I think it's very important for the Democrats to like the president to have a bill, and it would be much better for them to get it over with and finish it by Christmas. It's sucking up a lot of the air and time that they have to do other things. There are other things, it turns out, in the of importance in the world, and they need to have time to do these other things as well. And so I think there's a real hope and a real effort and a real push to try to get it done as close to Christmas as possible, at least.
Mm-hmm. And as far as you're concerned, what would be a meaningful bill?
That's a good question. From my particular point, I think the very first thing, and what they've decided is the minimal acceptable bill is something that considerably increases the amount of people in the United States who are covered by health insurance. I think coverage is the bottom line that they think is the single most important thing that is at all feasible. The second then is providing options, and if to the extent we can, as close to possible to a public option. I think that's both the Democrats and the president's second goal. The goal that gets kind of lost in all of this is systematic ways to reduce costs associated with healthcare.
Mm-hmm. And do you see that in all of the bills that are, they're now looking for a compromise on all of those, that they all have a way to significantly reduce costs?
I think they all have a way to make it, to have a reasonable hope of reducing costs, but I don't think it's not been the centerpiece of any of the bills that are left, as far as I can recall. And there's enough left, I'm not sure I remember all of them, but at least the principal ones on the table now, that seems to be the third and least clearly worked on alternative.
Right. And what about all these efforts to court Olympia Snow? Why is one Republican vote seemingly very important?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One is that it puts the Republican Party, so the political reason is it puts the Republican Party in the position of looking, you know, more and more like simply saying no rather than having sort of these principled objections. So if the president and the Democrats in the Senate are able to get even one Republican vote, they can say, we made good faith efforts, and at least some people in the party responded. And leave it at that. And so it kind of moves the onus towards the Republican Party from that politically. There's a second reason, which is that getting things through the Senate is complicated enough because it's not a simple majority. While it's true that the Democrats have 60 votes and so could invoke cloture in principle, that's very hard to ensure that that's going to happen. And even one more person, in this case Olympia Snow, gives them at least one possible other way of getting the bill through the Senate.
Yeah, but she's not likely to vote for that if there is a public option, right? If there is one in a final bill, skip her vote.
That's probably the case, although she's going to be under considerable pressure in her now that she's shown a willingness to consider alternatives that the Democrats are considering. I think that's going to, you know, sort of re-up the pressure on her too. So it's not inconceivable, but I think it's relatively unlikely that she would actually vote for it.
Mm-hmm. And what about this other method that we've talked about before, where you don't get the 60 votes, but you can do this through reconciliation? That was talked about earlier. Is that still a possibility, and how would that work?
So it is a possibility. And with budget reconciliation, since we do need to have a budget, we do need to have a going through to the next year. It has become part of the process of the Senate that doesn't have a filibuster. So if the Democrats, in effect, simply say add the health care bill as an amendment to the budget process, then it's in an area in which the filibuster is not used, so it would be just a 50 vote.
Mm-hmm.
It's straining the sort of logic of the process and the reason for having this exception to the filibuster anyway, and so it's a last gasp effort to get it through.
The other question that the American people keep having is, and all the polls seem to indicate again and again that the American people voted for some kind of substantial change here, and they really want a public option. A large majority of the American people want a public option. Why is it so hard for anything like that to get through without a whole lot of debate about it? Why doesn't it just fly through?
So there's two parts to the answer. One is the sort of narrow political. So imagine the Republicans. Suppose they had, you know, just divided the vote evenly with the Democrats. So they had 50 seats. They had essentially all the conservative vote. What they really need in their individual states then is to get 50% of that 50%. So they really only need a substantial minority of the total national vote if it's coming from Alabama, Mississippi, for example, or my state, to get elected, since the conservatives are not sort of uniformly distributed across the United States. And so they're representing a majority of their state, but a minority of the entire population.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives, and so it may very well be that for many of them, there may actually be a majority in their electoral constituency who are not in favor of a public option. So that'd be one reason. A second reason is that Republicans have, lost much of their moderate wing in both the House and the Senate, and so they're a much more conservative group than they were even just a few years ago. And so they're kind of resting on their hardcore base, which in either party, your really hard base is a minority in the population.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the Blue Dog Democrats do have to worry about reelection if they vote for this bill? Is that a problem?
It's certainly an element, and it really depends on individual cases, and it's really hard for them to forecast because a fair number of them are not up for re-election in 2010, so they're looking further into the future. That makes it easier for the rest of the Democrats to keep those sort of moderate Democrats who aren't immediately up for election, because there are a lot of other things that can happen in between time. It's the people who are up now, who are coming up for election, who have the most to fear about this particular bill.
And what about liberal Democrats? Do they stand a chance of losing if nothing significant passes?
I think all Democrats are worried about taking a hit if nothing passes. The only advantage for those who are coming from the more liberal constituencies is that they're not going to vote for the Republican alternative in almost all circumstances, and so they have to worry about challenges in the nomination process in the primaries.
We'll move on to Afghanistan and Iraq and other topics in just a moment. It's All Things Political for this Monday, and we welcome your phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our guest this hour is Professor John Aldrich, Professor of Political Science at Duke University. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, a portrait of President Herbert Hoover, is going to be aired tonight on public television, titled Landslide. It's directed by Chip Duncan from the Duncan Group, which is based here in Milwaukee, and produced by Chip and Tracy Dorsey. They'll both be with us next hour to talk about the life and the presidency of Herbert Hoover. All right, two phone calls now, 800-486-8655. Frank from Madison, our first caller. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi.
It's a very fine guest. I would like to ask him to what degree he thinks the climate change, global warming debate seems to have cooled. I'm trying not to make puns, to the degree that there's been a campaign to suggest that the problem isn't real. And then second, is there enough public interest in it to keep the politicians to their fire, feet to the fire, in that the 350 campaign occurred this weekend, and yet the United States is certainly not the most active, perhaps obstructionist nation when it comes to the Copenhagen conference that's coming up in December. So thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Bye.
Okay, so the first is sort of the ardor cooling for climate change, and I think the answer is yes, and it's yes because there's so many clamoring immediate problems and events that are happening right now, things we're going to be talking about pretty soon, plus the healthcare, plus over all of this, the economic slump has made it more difficult to keep that at the top of people's minds. So that's a sort of background, and the The second thing is we have not had a mechanism by which the public has been able to really press politicians about the climate change, for those in the public who want to. As the caller mentioned, very good questions, by the way, the 350 degree per 350 parts per billion or whatever it is campaign was this weekend was an attempt to get that going. I haven't had a chance to really scan lots of the media about their reactions to that. My guess is it doesn't seem to have gotten as much attention as I'm sure the people had hoped it would, who planned it. The biggest change now, of course, is having the Democratic unified majority around a president who thinks it's an important problem. And so that gives us the best window of opportunity we've had. On the other hand, because it has become the third event on their list after the economic stimulus package and all the related set of things, some of which are still have to be worked on, and the health care, it's not that they're going to be tired or anything, but there is a degree of exhaustion, and we're beginning to enter an election year in the near future. Mm-hmm. All of this is going to make that somewhat harder and harder for climate change to be pressed upwards to the politicians when there are lots of reasons to be spending time on other things.
A lot was said about stimulus money going to alternative energy, windows and solar and all of that, back when we were talking more about stimulus money. Has any significant amount of money gone into that, do you know?
I don't know where exactly it is right now. There has been some of it. The problem from a political point of view, at least a political perspective, is that it takes will take a long time before the most important benefits of that are felt, and it turns out we have election every 2 years, and and especially our members of Congress like to see something happen more quickly, so that they can begin to claim credit for it, and so it's really difficult to do this sort of long term time frame kind of actions, and so it doesn't get the highest priority all the way through.
Thanks, Frank, for your call. We go next to Ray from Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Good morning. Something you said earlier in the show, Kathleen, that the majority of the public in America wants single payer. I believe that. I know from talking with friends and coworkers that has got to be the truth. But what we see happening is our government does not represent the people. It is representing the top 1%, the people with money, and that's why we will never have a single-payer plan. And I don't understand why conservatives are against this, because most conservatives are probably business owners and want to keep their money. How can we compete with other countries that have single-payer plans, and the workers in other countries don't have to worry about being sick and losing 6 weeks of work and maybe thereby losing their homes, where in this country, conservatives don't want to make us competitive. It makes no sense, and the government really, really is letting us down, and I'm ashamed of what's happening. I really am. And they call themselves Democrats. Who is standing up for the average American? And I really don't think this plan is going to fly. They're going to water it down, and it's going to be good for the health companies. It's going to be good for the nonprofit hospitals and whatnot, but it's not going to be good for the average person or the average business owner.
Professor Aldrich, thank you for the call.
Yes, so I want to make a distinction between single payer option and public option. They're slightly different, and it's very, very likely if we do get a public option, it won't be a single plan, but a choice over a range of them. The apparently successful programs elsewhere really vary over how much public options, a mixture of public and private plans, and so that are available, and support from the government for private options and that sort of thing. So what this means is, it seems to me, there are several different strategies that could lead to a significant improvement. And it's not obvious that we're picking any one of them. That is, there's something to the principal, you know, concerns of the of Ray, that that the role of large money in elections does make unequal attention to considerations, and so yes, there is something to that. I'd like to sort of add that there were different kinds of conservatives, and some of them are the kind that Ray was talking about, and it is sort of a surprise that that there may not be more support among some conservatives. I will point out that businesses are more supportive of healthcare reform now than they were the last time it came up, or even the last four or five times it came up back into the 1950s. So at least there's some progress along those lines. But there are a whole other set of conservatives who are motivated more by social issues and are not looking for the government to get out, but to get involved, in certain kinds of things. And so the Republican Party, to the extent that it's purely the conservative party, actually has a mixture of different kinds of people that are serve as their base.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Afghanistan for a moment, where 14 Americans were killed on Monday, two separate incidents involving helicopters. It just seems to be very difficult to come up with a strategy that lessens the violence here and in which we are not paying a significant cost in terms of loss of American lives, in terms of loss of some civilians in Afghanistan as well. How is the president struggling with this, and why has this gone on for so long?
So my impression, I don't have, of course, any inside knowledge about the president's thinking particularly, but I think I think he's one of the elements that's going on is it's not really an Afghanistan war. It's an Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they're related, and the people move back and forth across the border, unlike our troops or the Pakistanis or Afghanistan, that is our side, has a border that the Taliban and Qaeda don't. And that's complicating things. And so part of it, I think, is waiting to see how the Pakistani push that's going on right now, which I gather is having the first signs of some successes, at least, how that's dealing with the bases that are available for the Taliban in Pakistan, because if they lose that, you know, they'll be the second major place that they will have lost in Pakistan, and they may very well be pushed even more heavily into Afghanistan, which is both a serious risk and a potential opportunity. That is, if the Pakistanis are able to, if not seal their border, at least make it a less of a sanctuary from the Afghanistan's perspective, it gives our forces, the coalition forces, a chance to coordinate on you know, where the enemy are all within our direct reach. So all of this is meaning that it's hard for the president to figure out what to do, because it's not even clear what the status quo is going to be in a month. Mm-hmm. And so it is a difficult issue. It's going to be very expensive. It's going to be potentially very costly in terms of lives. Ours, any other nations that were willing to support us, and of course the Afghanistan themselves. And so this is a big, serious kind of decision that is being made now instead of, you know, when it should have been made in 2002, 3, 4 time period.
And then we've got Iraq, where 150 people were killed yesterday in twin car bombs, the violence escalating in that country.
Yes. This is, if you think back, we're sort of moving back to pre-surge days. It seems like it, and that's a scary prospect. The hope was that, of course, that the that we would be able to get enough peace and enough stability for the current government to be able to maintain control, and this is the challenge now to see if they are able to, in effect, have their own surge and be able to stop this. It, of course, with car bombs, it's almost impossible. And so it's not the stopping of the people, individuals who are going to do the car bombing, but of the base from which they are recruited and trained and sent out.
Yeah. Let's go to Lucy from Ashland next. Hi, Lucy.
Hi. I have a question about healthcare. Can we go back to that?
Sure.
Okay. I am one of the uninsured and have been for a long time and desire not to be part of this healthcare system, which I don't feel has to do with preventing illness, educating people how to take care of themselves, working on, and as your guest has said, the legislators want things that happen, like in 2 years, a change. Well, a life is probably 80 years long, and we have to look at what's going to be, you know, the long-term results of change. And
why don't you have health insurance? Is it not available where you work, Lucy? Or,
well, I am self-employed.
Uh-huh.
I do energy medicine, herbalism, and biofeedback, and massage.
Mm-hmm.
So I have my own business. I have time. There's no way I could have health care, and I really don't believe in system the way it is, and people not knowing how to take care of themselves and not caring how to take care of themselves, and having insurance is insurance to get ill. That's our philosophy. It's more like, you know, if you have insurance, then you can get sick and go to the doctor.
Well, some people get sick because they get sick. It's not, you know, they don't will themselves to be sick, or they take care of themselves and they still get sick. You know, it happens, doesn't it? Or they have accidents?
Yes, yes. That I would believe, you know, I would be in favor of accidental care, things that are accidental like that, but the majority of people are not taking care of themselves. Look at the food that we have. I mean, my degree is in public health nutrition, and all my life I've tried to eat good food. I've grown my own food, taking responsibility for myself.
Mm-hmm. What aspects do you see in the public health care debate, Professor, look at the issue of taking care of ourselves, of preventive health?
Well, yeah, about as much as, is it Lucy, the caller?
Yes.
That is, I had said that, you know, that cost reduction is not sort of a high priority. From an economic perspective, we would say, you know, cost reduction, but I think she's right that the two single most important things we could do that would help reduce society's burden on healthcare is to have programs that, and it's not even just healthcare, through school lunch programs and so forth that and education that emphasize prevention, and the second is personal responsibility, taking responsibility for your own life well-being. I certainly wouldn't want me to take responsibility for if I come down with something, but I do think that we all should take responsibility for maintaining ourselves in at least reasonably good shape, and you know, eating more or less right. I know it's not going to be impossible to do that all the time, but it is our responsibility. It's not society's. It's not the government's. It is our own. And but if we build a healthcare prevention program that helps. Encourage us to take that full responsibility, I think that's the single most important place where we could get the most substantial cost reductions. Again, it is over the long term, but over a lifetime. But from our point of view as individuals, as members of society, that's what matters to us is our lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Lucy. Bruce from Milwaukee, hello.
Hello.
Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I'm calling about bankruptcy from... medical injury or illness. And, you know, there has been nothing to address the changes in the bankruptcy laws, which were set up, which were revised in 2005, with seriously penalized people who, you know, find themselves in this predicament where, you know, they can hardly afford to pay their health insurance, let alone their other bills, because they're just simply overwhelmed by medical expenses. And no one is addressing this issue, and there are people going bankrupt left and right because of the cost of medical care.
Professor Aldrich.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's not at all a funny matter, but boy, this is something that I really know relatively little about in terms of facts and figures. Certainly feel a great deal of sympathy to this case, to this problem. Many people do, don't have long-term, healthcare options available to them until they hit the point of Medicaid, which requires you to be essentially bankrupt, as I recall. So, it is an issue, and I think the reader or the caller is correct. We aren't. It's certainly not one of the primary things that anybody's taking into consideration.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's look at the issue of unemployment in this country for a while, because the figures are becoming alarmingly high, 10%. Detroit as high as 15%, which is really high. What do you see on the horizon in terms of job creation, in terms of what needs to be done to get people back to work?
It seems to me that it is a difficult issue. Unemployment is, as I like to say, a lagging indicator. It comes, it gets worse even when things, rest of the economy starts to turn around. And the way the economy's been turning around has not been in the directly developing an employment base. So even if, the stock market's doing okay, all that kind of stuff, although it's a long way to go before that's the case, we're likely to face a lot of unemployment. So it seems to me there's a twofold strategy we need. One is to provide people with the ability to make it through, the unemployed to make it through to the time when there is greater employment being generated by the economy. And the second part, of course, is to ensure that there is something being done in the economy to generate employment. Propping up banks is an indirect kind of way of doing it. That is, you prop them up, they make money available. Industry starts to pick up. What they do first, of course, is use their current employees more fully. First, then go to sort of temporary employment until they're confident that there's going to be enough growth in the economy and their part of the economy to hire people permanently. So we are looking at months and months from now, even if the recession has ended by the technical definitions, we're looking at months and months before it's going to really show up in job creation. Most of the whole idea of the shovel readiness for the stimulus package spending was that it would generate jobs because they need people to man the shovel. Mm-hmm. So that part of it is in fact moderating, at least to some extent, the decline in employment. So it'd be even worse without that. A lot of the money that goes to things like the banking industry and so forth is indirect and takes months before it shows up in the creation of jobs. So it's a really difficult issue, and we need both the short term and the long term. Going back to the Great Depression, probably many of the programs we remember most are the CCC, the Civil Conservation Corps, and the WPA, the Works Project Administration, and they were just hiring people by the government to do what turned out to be really wonderful things for the country until the business part of the economy and industry got back on its feet.
Mm-hmm. And that was on the table in terms of what we ought to be doing 7 or 8 or, I don't know, maybe even a year ago. What happened to that, of creating something like a WPA to give people jobs? Jobs are important.
Yeah, it died on the vine.
It sure did.
Correct. And I mean, one of the reasons it did was that I think people all of a sudden became scared of how much money we were spending and how deeply in debt we were going, and could we afford to go further? So that was part one. And part two was that the economy did begin to stabilize, made it seem like less of an impending crisis, and allowed people to turn their attention elsewhere.
More phone calls for Professor Aldrich in just one moment. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 26th of October. We're talking about a number of issues, looking overseas at the violence in both Afghanistan and Iraq over the weekend. Healthcare reform still on the table, inching closer to some kind of bill, but still unknown is where the administration would like to go with this issue, and whether or not a bipartisan bill is in the works, and how meaningful healthcare reform will be. What about jobs? Let's put that back on the table here for a moment. Do we need something like a WPA to get that unemployment rate, to say nothing of what the underemployment rate must be in this country, to get people jobs, which would stimulate the economy? Well, it's very high, this rate. And whatever else you'd like to put on the table, we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we're going to be talking about Herbert Hoover, President Herbert Hoover. Tonight, a portrait of the president will be airing on public television. It's directed by Chip Duncan from the Duncan Group here in Milwaukee, and he's also produced the film along with Tracy Dorsey. Chip and Tracy will both be with us to talk about Herbert Hoover's accomplishments. We think of him as a guy who got us into the Depression and couldn't get us out of the Depression. Actually, his accomplishments as a humanitarian and Secretary of Commerce in the Coolidge and Harding administrations were quite significant. So we'll look at that and get a picture of Herbert Hoover the second hour of our program. Back to phone calls. Professor John Aldrich, University Professor of Political Science at Duke University, is our guest this hour. And our next call is from Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning, Professor. Good morning.
Hi.
My problem with the economy and everything that's going on is a lack of jobs and the lack of job creation, and that's what's going to kill the Democrats in the next two election cycles. If they don't get that unemployment rate down, no matter how nicely they can talk and all of these great plans that they have, but the problem in creating jobs. Is that you have to look at the entrepreneur, and I'm one, a tiny one, but I have the potential of hiring two or three people. But under the current circumstances, when I see all of this, you know, this mess going on things in general, I have no confidence. And if they can't build confidence so that people are confident to, you know, to go ahead with a business venture, then they're in trouble.
I'm sorry, did I interrupt you? That's correct. In fact, that's the sort of standard. That's the real problem about dramatic economic change is that, you know, people are planning for the future, and if they can't figure out what's going to happen, it's very difficult to make those plans. It's a perfect example of exactly the problems we face. This sort of stabilization takes a long time to work through the system before we can count on it. Are even the people who've gotten a lot of money so far, the banks and the car companies, are they going to still be around? Just those. And that's what's been getting the sort of most immediate attention. A second kind of problem that's quite related to this is that, since we're not particularly a manufacturing economy as much as we used to be, you know, we have it's very difficult to provide the money to. You can't just give it to GM and they'll hire lots of people anymore. The way it used to be, and you know, with our manufacturing having moved offshore in so many different directions, that's yet another difficulty why it's hard to get our economy. Getting people back into the employment, it's lengthening. If it was a lagging indicator always, it's now an even greater lag than it used to be, and that's yet another problem. Just one other thing on the political side, it's true that incumbents who are not able to be able to get the economy at a reasonable working level pay a price. In this case, it really puts people in an awkward position because if the Republicans couldn't do it and the Democrats couldn't do it, where do we go? And my advice is to try to get people who you think are more likely to have the right solutions to run for office in the first place.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. We go to Carol from Plymouth next. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. I'd like to ask that you define economic growth in terms of how we achieve or what our goal is for economic growth. I believe that our materialism and the whole what I seem to feel is the definition is a fallacy, and also that we are basing our economic growth greatly on having wars and on the defense and all that stuff.
So the standard definition of economic growth is increase in what's known as gross domestic product, which is the stuff we make. It's actually that measure that we usually use was actually invented in the Depression. It was invented to try to figure out what was actually going on. Before then, we didn't have very systematic measures of actual economic performance. And so one effect of the Depression was to provide the impetus to try to at least get some kind of measure. Okay, so that's good. But it's long been understood, indeed, even by its creator, Simon Kuznets, that it only measures a very specific part of the of what we think of as our well-being of our society, and there's lots of things that aren't included in that. Both in the narrow economic terms, I was just reading something quite recently, I think it was in the Atlantic magazine, which pointed out that these houses that are partially built and sitting unsellable in failed developments right now are actually adding positively to the gross to our measure of economic growth, even though they're actually a drag on the economy. And so there are things just about the economy, but our overall well-being is not simply just are we getting richer as a society.
Thanks for the call. We go to Rob from Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I'm just past Woodruff on my way up to Ashland, but I have a question for your guest. It's been on my mind for a while. We already have national health insurance, as much as conservatives say they don't want it. It exists for our elderly, anybody over 65. And I wonder why we can't roll that out to the whole population. And because right now, Medicare covers only the most expensive people to cover. And if you roll it out to all the young people and everybody else, I would think that might become a solvent option, and we'd have the answer. Just an idea.
Thanks, Rob.
Yes. Actually, that was one of the original plans was, you know, sort of Medicare all around. There's a sort of joke about that people in the public often don't realize, don't think of that as it's so successful. People don't think of it as a government program. They expect the government programs to not be successful, but for the people, it helps. It really helps. And so the joke was that I want to keep my Medicare and not go on the government program.
Right.
So that was a proposal. The principal opposition to it is that the concern that doctors who currently take Medicare payments, they often paid less than they are if they were people who have private insurance, Blue Cross Blue Shield or whatever. And so there was a concern that if you expand that out, that the doctors would take a serious hit. And so the doctors aren't very much in favor of that. From my point of view, it provides a basis for trying to figure out a way to make it a genuinely workable process across the range of people. My particular preference would be, we know it works, we know people who use it like it. I would make it a society-wide program, but that's me.
But it also, much has been said about the expense of the Medicare program and how it really needs to be refashioned so that it won't cost as much money, right?
Right, that's correct. It would, yes. I mean, it is, you know, a single payer in that option, in that kind of case. And we do need to rethink how it would work when it's the not just a portion of the healthcare insurance, but a whole thing. It is quite a bit different to go from, you know, a fraction of the population to the entire population.
Mm-hmm.
And many people, of course, supplement their Medicare with private insurance, so it's really not necessarily even moving to a single payer system.
Thank you, Rob. Dave from Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, Dave. How are you?
Good.
Good.
So my comments on healthcare, and I was listening to the program as I'm driving, and I was curious about the earlier caller focusing on health prevention as opposed to as a way to reduce costs and need for healthcare. And my comments would be, it's probably difficult to implement, but trying to diversify the payout based on things that are accidental or non-self-inflicted and things that are just based on poor lifestyle habits or, you know, eating too much, drinking too much, those types of things that would lead one to need more health care versus someone that's trying to live a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, in some ways we do that now by variations in the you know, cost as you get older and so forth and so on. It's a very complex thing to sort of figure out what, you know, if you have diabetes, how much of is your lifestyle contributing to it and how much of it was genetic. We tend not to have to make the decision on that kind of thing, and this would put a priority in trying to figure out sort of where responsibility lies. The general idea is it's just easier to pool. If you pool across everybody, then you sort of can smooth that out and not have to worry so much about that, and put in incentives for healthy living in other ways.
Thanks for the call. Email has come in. Would you like to comment on Dick Cheney's statements on Afghanistan? And let me broaden that a little bit. Would you like to comment on Dick Cheney's increasing presence in this country?
Yeah. Sorry. So I will start with Afghanistan, and that is my response to him, is that if Afghanistan had had a higher priority in the Bush administration, it wouldn't be as difficult for, it may not have been as difficult, at least for Obama, to figure out what it is that needs to be done now to try to salvage a difficult circumstance.
Okay. Anything noteworthy we should be anticipating this week?
I'm sorry.
Is there anything that we ought to be anticipating this week? Any special votes taking place?
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that. I wanted to say one other thing about Iraq and Afghanistan,
yes,
if
go
I
ahead.
Might,
oh, sure.
Which is that we ought to have a realistic expectation about what our role is in each of those. What we know we can do is militarily deal with governments that we find, we can get both Saddam Hussein and Taliban out of office. The presumption that we can resolve underlying divisions in society, but in fact, most clearly in Iraq, where there were three groups that are seriously competing for that have serious issues among themselves, it's very difficult for us to imagine that we can just resolve that ourselves.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us for the hour. Thanks. Professor John Aldrich, he's a professor of political science at Duke University. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee as well. News coming up, and we'll continue with more Monday Conversation here on the Ideas Network.